You're now tuned in to this week's episode of Tribal Research Specialists, the podcast, a podcast about tribal people, our communities, and discussions on research traditions. We aim to uncover the true meaning of research methodological approaches that are currently operating in tribal life, with implications for tribal communities and avenues for knowledge production. So that's what you call the old time war dance, the Sawench. Now, apparently that was the old name for the old time war dance. Now, what that was, I don't know. Wasn't alive then. Not a lot of detail saved from those time periods. There wasn't tape recorders, you know, those kind of things. But apparently, now this is the history, and we've talked about this before, but Paul Antone, he's the one who said, you know, around 1873, very specific, he has a very specific date and year. He said he was with a party of Salish folks on their way to the plains to probably run down some buffalo or what have you. And he ran into some of your folks and observed. Yeah, observed them doing what they termed the grass dance. And apparently what he said at this time was that your folks and my folks had a very similar war dance way prior to the introduction of this grass dance way. Prior to. So I guess it starts to make me wonder. Or is the word introspect? I don't know what that is. I'll have to ask a psychologist to introspect, if you will, or to think, well, I wonder what other areas that we commonly assume as maybe quasi-traditional or from the old times, or that is old-timey, that may or may not be. One of those things I wondered, and I thought maybe was a little more resilient than some of the dances, was like the structure of leadership. I don't know, but I'm just curious about that, because apparently some of the notable things, and these seem pretty resilient to me, from, you know, the mid 1800s up until the last of the chiefs, but you know, a chieftainship, I suppose. A lot of people think of them as hereditary, passing from father to son, son to father to grandson, etc. However, that was not always the case, apparently. And someone could refuse to be a chief. They could say, "Nah, I'm not up to the job. I don't think I'm not good enough. I'm not admired by the people, or I'm too poor," those kind of things. So oftentimes the hereditary nature of a chieftainship could be stopped in that way. And apparently, and I don't know how true a lot of this stuff is, but apparently it was pretty rare for a hereditary chieftainship to pass through three generations before there was some turnover. Now, I don't know, what is your thoughts on that tradition from your area?
Well,
or is this a total curveball?
curveball. You're curveballing me.
That, well, okay. Well, field it, man. You can get it.
Hips down. Elbows in.
Hips down.
Glove on the ground. Glove on the ground. Oh, man. Chin level. Not chin down. Chin level. Boom. Glove on the ground. My daddy, so I say, glove on the ground. Make a wall. So, what I would say is that for the crow, there's no real evidence to show that hereditary chief was ever a thing.
Right.
But I mean, that's not to say it's not possible for someone's son to become a chief, but that's not necessarily how things happen. So
yeah,
at least in the historic time period of the crow, you were defined, you were eligible to be a chief based on achievement. That didn't make you a chief just because you accomplished those achievements. People had to follow you. You didn't run for chieftainship. You know, you weren't like, I'm running, guys. People just follow you. And then once you become a leader of a group, then you ascend up the ranks. But this is all predicated on three major things. For one, the accomplishment of and the collection of war deeds. That's major. Two, character. You know?
Yeah. That's an important one.
Character.
Hey, your mic is rubbing around on your zipper there, creating a lot of noise.
Is that better?
Still getting some rubbage, but not as bad.
I don't know. What's it rubbing on?
Rubbing on your collar, man.
My collar?
Rubbing on your polo.
It's a Columbia Costco find. You know about them Costco finds?
Oh, yeah. You're just strolling. You just want to get like a cheese and cracker snack or a... Try the king salmon that came in with the garlic butter.
Oh, I was just going to say the garlic butter.
And then you walk across this table filled full of shirts.
And they're like $9. I bought three Columbia sweaters there.
Yeah.
I even have
all the same color.
No, I don't know. I got a green one and a blue
Not there yet.
Not there yet. Oh, then good. I got an Eddie Bauer.
Oh.
So, you know, I'm kind of styling.
You're kind of a big, you got the name brand, you got the different colors. Yeah. The fact that you even have a Costco card, that's a mark.
Whoa.
That could be a chieftainship quality.
Well, and I think we're even like gold members, I think, or something. You know, the other day
get a free passport picture every year.
We went into Costco. This is a couple weeks ago. And I bought a six pack of Spam. Misty was like, what are you doing? So I mean, it was cheap, you know. Low sodium, 20% or 30% less sodium, dude.
That's the one you have to get now, get it past 30.
Yeah, and then you cut them into the small slices, you put a little bit of cheese on them and just fry them up.
Oh man.
And then you toast some bread, make a little Spam cheese sandwich. If you were into commodities, I grew up with commodities, it was called luncheon meat.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually think luncheon meat tastes better than Spam.
I would agree. Had more flavor.
It had more flavor, less sodium. But I used to love the commodity powdered eggs and the luncheon meat mixed together.
Yeah. Well, the only thing about the luncheon meat, you know, it wasn't conveniently square like the
eggs. It was in that. Can the silver can.
The tin, yeah.
So did you?
That was all right.
Oh, did you ever used to color the commodity boxes, the cereal boxes?
No, I didn't do that.
That was like
I got.
Remember they were white.
I gone through. Yeah. I gone through many boxes of corn flakes, but not didn't color. Any of them. Maybe I did. I don't remember.
You probably.
Anyway, so let's. I might have. What do you now? Let's get back to this.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was I saying?
Accomplishments.
Oh,
I don't remember.
So I would say
war deeds, character.
War deeds, character, and then spiritual power. I would say.
Right.
and I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. I know of no band chief or head chief that was without spiritual power.
Right.
You know, even the least talked about chiefs in our history possessed.
I mean,
you weren't going to ascend through the ranks without spiritual power. So the Crows actually have a pretty sophisticated ranking system. So our military ranking system and our societal ranking system are the same, pretty, you know. The first position is what we call a little toe. And that's that's like a helper, like someone who just kind of helps out, and that's specific too to an age. So you're anywhere from 9 to 12 years old. And you'll go go to war with a war party. They might take two or three little toes with them, and they kind of stoke the fire and gather wood. Right. They won't engage in battle,
right.
But and that age, I'm sure, varied throughout time. But you know, it could be anywhere 9 to probably 14. You know, and then after that, you ascended into just Akduhia, which means just the warrior, the ones who go to war, you know. So it's like warrior proper, right?
Yeah.
Then you could become a scout. Chicha.
That's different than a warrior. Yep. I mean, is it a level up or is
a
it
level,
just a different role?
No, it's a level up. So if you're, by the time you're a warrior, you should at this point have your own medicine now. You're no longer borrowing the spiritual power of somebody else. So in the old days, a war leader might say, you can use my medicine when you go into this, but eventually you'll go in fast, or, you know, it could be yours, even if it's given to you by somebody else, but it kind of has to become yours, you know? And then you, after that, you become an old man scout. Chetizaka. And the old man scout is the leader of the scouts. And then they always say the leader, the war leader. But then I kind of feel like the next, it's a lateral move, the old man scout and what they call the pipe carrier.
Yeah.
So the pipe carrier is Ipche Akula or Akule. And that's the one who carries the pipe. He's the boss. When you go to war, it's his war leader's pipe that's guiding you there. And that's a big deal, you know? And it was even a big deal to steal those pipes from the enemy, the war leader's pipe.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
A chief named Grey Bull, his medicine song says, I'm going to steal the enemy's medicine pipe. Which is pretty cool.
Hmm.
And then after that, you become a band chief. So the Crows had three bands of the Crows, and you could become a band chief. And then in order to be what they call the owner of the camp, which is the leader of all three bands, you have to be one of these. And the last owner of the camp, meaning the last to be the chief of all the Crow chiefs, was a guy named Sits in the Middle of the Land, Owekwilawaja. And he died he was at the Fort Laramie Treaty signing in 1851, and he died in roughly the 1870s, I think, of pneumonia. But the last leader of the Mountain Crows was, and died in 1940 or 34, I think, was Chief Plenikus. Yeah, and so there wasn't, I don't know of any other leaders. Now, there's kind of a spiritual ascendancy too, because equivalent to the chiefs of the Crow were what they call the lodge erectors. The lodge erectors own the ceremonial lodge of the Tobacco Society. And those are still in existence.
those are they're not the chiefs as the one you mentioned. They're just leaders of particular things.
Of the hallmark ceremonial way of the Crow, the thing that defines us, the leaders of those, the lodge directors, they're paramount. They're like the chiefs would go to them for advice, especially if they were in the society, you know.
Yeah.
So those four deeds, though, those four main deeds that are needed to even be considered to be in the running, is the capture of an enemy's weapon, the touching of an enemy without killing him, to lead a successful war party, and then to cut a picketed horse.
Hmm. And if you did all those,
then you were eligible.
Then you're eligible.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you are.
No, it doesn't mean you are. And the last person,
because you still have some things.
Yeah, the last person ahead. Who have accomplished on record to have accomplished those four things was Joe Medicine Crow in World War II.
He did all those during World War
II. Yeah, he did all four of those things. Mm-hmm. Now, there's people argue about that because they'll say, well, he had to have been a pipe carrier to lead a successful war party, which he was not. But that's like tomatoes and potatoes.
Getting technical.
Yeah, getting real technical. And then on top of that, there was other deeds that one could collect, like what they call the deed of the day, which was the war leader on that particular expedition would say, this is the deed. And he would proclaim something. The first one to run through the camp will get the deed of the day. And there was another one, if you saved an enemy in battle, or saved a comrade in battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those didn't almost count like a challenge. As four main ones. Yeah, they were just like, you could say, like a subclass of deeds.
Right.
So it got pretty complex, because then it revolves around war societies, which is the Foxes, the Lumpwoods, the Muddy Hands, and the Big Dogs, and the Crazy Dogs, which was more of a vow, and there was all this other stuff, you know,
that
attached itself to a very complex war culture.
Huh. Now, I don't suppose, and maybe I'm wrong, probably very little of that exist today as far as who leads the tribe today. Is that true?
Well, yes and no, right? I would say that war system for all purposes, right? But the value of deeds is still very high and needed. It's needed for ceremonies. In fact, when they say just like any tribe, if some misfortune comes to you, you might invite somebody to your home or something and say, hey, can you pray for us? And they might pray for you and however that matters. In the old days, when a misfortune would happen, you would call upon a veteran to tell a war deed. Yeah. And the war deed is a reversal of bad luck, because he might say something like, I engaged the enemy and I returned untouched.
Yeah.
That's like a validation of some good luck happening to that individual. And so then he would say, I'm going to give that good fortune to you. So that still does happen to some degree. And that's actually where the tradition of when a feather drops at a powwow and they'll say, bring a veteran. Yeah. He's supposed to. So, in the original grass dance ceremony or the daytime dance ceremony or whatever tribe calls it, when an article fell off of your outfit that was deemed to be like, well, you put it on because it's ceremonial. Your bustles, your dance regalia was part of the ceremony. So any misfortune that happens within the ceremony is kind of considered like, well, maybe that shouldn't have happened. So they'll say, well, let's have someone who had seen the enemy reverse that. So they might come in and pick it up, and they'll say, you know, I touched my enemy and he didn't touch me back. And then they'll hit the drum, right? And everybody, right. Then it reverses it. And then that goes into a little pile of things. And at the end of the dance, a song is sung and that is returned. It's returned back to its owner. But
right.
I'm kind of getting off track here, but your question was more about, I guess, like, is there remnants of that left, right?
Yeah.
And I would say the war deeds, the using of war deeds is still used. And
right.
And there are things that are from the old war societies that are still in existence. You know, the Fox Society songs, the Lumpwoods and the Crazy Dog songs are still alive. But yeah. Also what they call the Warrior's Homecoming, which is basically it's the scalp dance and this thing called the Shoshone dance. You could say the daytime dance ceremony is part of that, and then a thing called the long dance. Those still are in existence, although they're not as common as they used to be. Even within my lifetime, they're not as common, but they do exist. There's still people who know how to conduct those ceremonies, you know.
Right. But as far as
I rambled.
No. I mean, like current. So I'm trying to examine what is still existing and thriving today. Of course, a lot of it can't be, but I'm wondering some tribes have business councils, tribal councils. Some people have a chairperson
in their cabinet. I mean, we're pretty much a modern tribe with our chairman is what's alive is all the fringe stuff. So our chairman is still considered the supreme leader of the tribe. Where I would say in other tribes, the business council almost seems like it's like this thing over here where among the Crow, the chairman still is considered that. In fact, in Crow, people refer to him as Wajicha or, you know, the chief. And then he has advisors, which is equivalent to the old chief days when the chief, he would surround himself with former retired war leaders and law directors. And then he would have his own spiritual kind of, this is my guy, my medicine man, you know.
Yeah.
I don't like to use that word, but he would do that, you know. And then, of course, as long as his medicine is potent, that helps the success of the tribe, you know.
Right. So then, in general, you could say their influence is still pretty great. Probably not as influential as once. Yeah. There's probably fractions who don't agree, etc. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, which you could even argue that's a carryover from the old days, because in the old days, if you didn't want to follow that chief, you could still follow someone. You go and follow someone else, you know?
Right.
Which people say, like, tribal politics involves a lot of factionalism, which is, that's the way it's always been. It's just that it seems dysfunctional because it's just counter to we're supposed to respect the office now, right?
Right.
The office of the presidency, the office of the chairmanship, whatever that is. In the old days, if you wanted to follow this guy, candidate A, you just followed him. Or her.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of like this idea that kind of gets stuck in people's heads. Yeah. That there's one large tribe with one large leader, but that's not necessarily true.
I don't think that was the case for any tribe, at least in the Rockies and in the plains. I don't think, I'm certain they didn't travel in these big groups. Where like it's like the Sioux, where all the Sioux were together, or even all the Salish. When you really start looking at like the Bitterroot Salish and how many groups there were and where they were living, they're pretty independent of each other.
Right.
That's why, like, when they say, "Well, I'm Salish and we traveled to the plains for buffalo," I don't even necessarily know if I believe that. I think they were just there. That's where they lived.
Right.
So when the reservation era comes in, and all these groups get placed together, they mold their narratives together. So then they'll say, like, these stories become polished, and they'll say, when we travel out to the plains, well, that might be true for this group that came from this, right, this area, but three of the other groups were it's just where they lived was the plains. They were just plains Indians.
Right. So it's like some of the early estimates of population, you know, but prior to the horse, you know, it's in the tune of like 30,000 Salish, you know.
Oh yeah.
So when you think, oh well, when we went to the plains, hard to picture 30,000 people traipsing over to the plains, you know.
And there's not another tribe on the planet that would attack a tribe of 30,000 people. There'd be no war stories. There'd be none.
Yeah.
So
when
they say we attack the enemy camp, of 30,000 people, I don't care who you are, unless you have cannons or like, and that's why when Sitting Bull had his camp on the Little Bighorn, that's why it was such a massive thing.
Yeah,
unheard of to have that many people in one area. 30,000 people, that's Helena, Montana. That's the entire city of Helena just walking together. It's just, there'd be huge swaths of land just ripped apart.
Yeah,
trampled. I think in the winter they got into bigger groups, you know, but for the most part,
yeah,
I think it was more like family groups scattered across a landscape. You stay in communication, and there might be groups of 30 to 40 to 50 people in kind of a concentration. But for the most part,
right,
I hear stories all the time of someone say, me and my brother, they'll say in these old stories, we got our horses and we rode to our neighbors, and their camp might have been 10 miles down the road, but they knew where they were downriver, and they'd go and stay there for a couple of weeks. Or, you know, it's, I don't think it's anything like what we've been taught.
No, I don't think so. No. The biggest hunting party that, you know, I kind of come across, and certainly not complete, but a party of like 1,000 people or so.
Yeah, and that's a combination of tribes. See that in like,
yeah,
the fall.
Yeah, 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 yeah. A big party heading over to the plains, but yeah, you don't hear anything, or at least I haven't come across too much of anything larger than, you know, between 11 and 1200 folks, you know.
Yeah. And really what I notice is like people who are caught up in like numbers and timelines. Yeah. Those are like mood points a lot of times in research. But there's entire projects based around like lodge counts, and it's like, Okay, we've established that there's a fairly rough estimate of how many lodges and people are at this camp.
Yeah.
Now what? I mean, it's cool. It's cool, like, information.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it's like, okay, well, what if you did prove there was 30,000 people at this village?
Then what?
What now? Then what?
Yeah, pretty crazy.
It's
just that idea of you know, putting some reality into what we think about from the past, you know, and it sneaks its way into a lot of things.
It does, yeah. And like I said, the danger of this is that tribal people, that we believe that stuff now.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah. It becomes it becomes ingrained.
Yeah, like I've heard this polished, I've lived in Flathead long enough now to, I've heard this polished narrative of when the Salish went to the plains and hunted buffalo, and it's so dogmatic and it's so cut and dry, even like no other tribe smoked their meat the way we do, or no, it's just like, why would you even, these are pointless, you know, these are not, this is not, like, oh, and I've even heard it from Crow, like when I said, oh, I really like smoked dry meat. And they're like, oh, like you're one of them flatheads now. And then I visit my grandma and she'll say her grandma smoked meat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't they?
Doesn't make,
just like,
doesn't make
I'm
sense
sure there were Salish people who, I'm sure there was some Salish people that they just buy some meat once in a while. It's all situational. Yeah. It's like, well, let's just hang the meat. Let's just hang the meat, you know? It's like,
yeah, we ain't got no
whatever.
Wood.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. What is, I don't understand this. So, Crow people are mountain people, much like the Bitterroot. So, this designation of Plains Indians and Plateau Indians, and it's not even a thing. So like, when we say Plains Indians, we're not, at least I'm not referring to people who just live in the plains. I'm referring to a lifestyle.
Right. Which a cultural characteristic.
Yeah, uh-huh. Which I put the Nez Perce in there, the Shoshone in there, the Bitterroot Salish, uh-huh. Even the Pend'eré. I would even put Kootenays in there. I would put Sarcees in there. It's a lifestyle. Like if I dumped in 1700, if I grabbed a Crow man and dumped him in a Salish camp, is he not going to know what to do? Is he going to be like,
I can't eat that smoked meat.
I can't. Oh, what do I do?
I will not eat the smoked meat.
Am I on Mars? You know, it's like, it's not, dude, they're going to live real similar, man. And it's, I think where you get into real heavy differences is, the logistics of ceremonial life. But for the most part,
right.
When they say, oh, well, the Kiowas were the lords of the plains. They all were like,
was there a crown or a throne somewhere?
Was there like a tribe in the plains that just couldn't do it? They're like, we just can't get these horses figured out. I'm sure they're all pretty even. I'm sure there was some that at least to white folk, they stood out in a certain way. And then of course within tribes, like some tribes, I think the horse always kind of stayed utilitarian. I think there was some tribes that just kind of viewed them as a resource. And there's definitely some tribes that viewed them as like a spiritual being. But for the most part, I think every one of those were horsemen. They were horsemen.
Yeah. You kind of had to be.
Yeah, I would. It's like during World War I when they said there's people riding horses. I'm like, yeah, every guy could ride a horse. In 1914, every able-bodied male could ride a horse. I guarantee you.
Right. Yeah, but certain tribes were better than others, right?
Yeah, they're the Kiowa, and the Comanche. I'm getting fired up because anyway, let's just keep talking about what you want to talk about. What's your next thought, man.
Well, my next thought is my next thought is let's listen to this next song and then I'll let the next thought out. Are you ready? Be sure. So that's Paul Finley again, and he's singing another of the old time songs, kind of what you had referred to as in the Crow way, you know, when they're sending the scouts out. And I'm sure you guys had a familiar way of doing that. But they sing these songs around the camp. We've talked about it before, but this is one of the older songs. I'm sure they all kind of are in this genre. But it so then again, you know, certain ones were selected like you said, some of the younger folks, you know, 9 to 12, just preparing to go on a battle. Same way here in this region, you know, that a few of the younger ones, the novice warriors, would travel along and they'd be the water fetchers, just like you said, you know, or they'd erect their little war lodge wherever they were going to sleep, those kind of things. But this song would send those warriors out onto their battles. But you know, one of the important things I think in this whole in this conversation that we had previous, and this one now, when we're speaking about war, we have to also consider, you know, what was war, and how did it define leadership, and importantly, what is the, I guess, the virtues of war, you know, and how the virtues of war translate into the next step, especially for the male, you know, in their leadership roles. But so when we're talking about virtues, you know, we can think of things such as bravery or honesty, some of the things that the good chief would require, you know, being hospitable, generous, having some degree of influence through their, I guess, the way they speak. And again, like you said, their spiritual power, all those things kind of played into this, I don't know what you call it, like a complete expression of virtue. So what my question is, and my next thought on that is, how much of that, those qualities or those virtues do we still hold strongly? And how much of that do we, or have we, adopted more of a mainstream approach, such as the idea of honesty? And I bring that up because, you know, the boarding school kind of did a number on a lot of our folks, and, you know, they were made to really embrace the idea of being dishonest so that they could either avoid getting in trouble, those kind of things. But I guess when you speak about a code of morality, what were some of the more important virtues that were held among the tribes? That was kind of my next thought. I mean, there's some obvious ones.
Yeah,
go ahead.
But I also think that this is where it gets really different from like a Euro-American concept of moral and person and ethic. And the terms might be the same, like ethic, and in both societies. I actually think that tribal people have adopted, because of the boarding school and the church and other efforts, we've adopted this form of American popular culture and how we look at an individual. This is, if we had a sponsor, this is where our commercial would be.
Pringles chips, they are the lightest, fluffiest.
This is what is that law firm cup I had? This is brought to you by
Crowley and Flake.
Crowley and Flake, and
yeah.
What else?
Been an offender bender?
Been an offender? Were you wrongfully terminated?
adopted the adoption of mainstream qualities.
That's, yeah, which this, is like, I mean, which nobody even does. The truth is that standard was created, and the very country we live in does not adhere to it at all. This country was not founded on those qualities of honesty and the whole Ten Commandments thing morality and ethic. What I think tribal viewed the most important was more of a reciprocal relationship with morality and with success and different things. Is those around you,
yeah,
Are they healthy? Are they clothed? Are they fed? And are they finding success? And if you have a household of people and all of them are in that position, someone might look at you and say, well, he clearly is making the right decisions because around him success is happening. Now, so this idea of good and bad, at least for the crow, historically or traditionally, we didn't have this good and bad, evil versus triumphing. What it is we're made up of both of them. And and it's our job to kind of deal with this thing within us. And if I take a step in the right direction and then good comes from that, then I take another step in that same direction. Now, the moment I might hit something, I might give it a few efforts. And if that doesn't happen, then clearly something is telling me to take a step in a different direction. And I think that's a really condensed version of what I'm trying to say, but I think nowadays Native communities, and I'm guilty of this too, will judge an individual and will say, wow, he's done this. And it's like, wow, that's really not, I think, how it was in the past, because for one, we're basing wrongdoing on a standard that's set by a whole different way of thinking, where it's like, well, his wife is healthy and is dressed nice, or vice versa.
Right.
That the wife is seen as successful because her kids look good, her home looks good, and they see her at ceremonies and they're like, oh, she was chosen to bring this water in or whatever. That's all like because of decision making and just, you know, that's why I say, like, I don't think Native people had goals, but we had direction. If that makes sense. Like, I don't think it's very European or very American to be like, my goals are this. This is what I want to become. It's a no-brainer for Indian people to be like, well, I want to become a badass warrior, or I want to become a badass whatever ceremonial leader. That was the goals of Native people, you know. So we don't need to say like, well, this by this year I'm going to do it. And it's not like that at all. Where I see it's common is in jiu-jitsu, like training Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and much like probably wrestling, your progression is on you. It's not like, oh, you, Sean Dean, you learned a sprawl, a single leg, an ankle pick, and a back take. Therefore, you're at the next level. Are you proficient? Are you proficient in those? And that also means that your brother can get there quicker. You know, he can become more proficient. His technique is tighter and he finds more success. That doesn't mean you're not going to get there. But maybe to the standard that we hold now, everybody else is here and they're all saying like, Sean Dean sucks. When it's like, that's not even like a thing. Like, I don't even think people thought that way really, you know, like it was more like, well, once you get here, then you're there. Then it's like, whatever. It's not even a thing, you know? So I kind of feel like that's how our society worked is everyone had the same goal, was to become a black belt. Like in jiu-jitsu, you want to be a black belt, but you don't say, I want to be a black belt. You just say, I'm going to learn these techniques and then become a blue belt. Now I'm going to learn these techniques and become a purple belt or be proficient in these things. So I think our society was like, everyone wants to be a black belt. We don't need to. So the standard to get there is different than like, am I making any sense?
Just keep going and we'll see if it clears up.
I'm in the weeds here.
No, I get it.
Okay. Maybe
I get it.
Clear it up for the audience.
Okay. Well, you know, so we can operate off of like a binary of good and bad, you know, and put things in a good column and good things in a bad column, but it's very simplified, but it helps describe things, I guess, in a way. But really, the understanding, and maybe other tribes share the same belief, but there really is, like you said, that the lines are very blurred between good and bad, and it's more the action of a person and how they take or how they use something and in the way in which they use it. It's similar to, you know, I guess how you would treat a person, you know, if you're a brave person, you could be brave and go do bad things, you know, just indiscriminately kill people with your bravery, or you could use your bravery to do good things and defend your people in some way. So the virtue of bravery then can land in either a good or bad category, but it's still brave either way you look at it.
Yeah. This is an interesting topic. And maybe we should dedicate like a whole podcast to this.
I think so. Because there are other virtues that are not like that. Like honesty, you know, honesty, I think, now just let me contemplate that for a second. There's no bad way to be honest, really. I mean, you could be honest and hurt people's feelings, I guess. Be over honest, you know.
I don't know. Well, honesty, don't get confused with the need to say something. So I've heard people, right, and I'm guilty of this. This is because I used to think this. Well, I'm just being honest. So you'd say something.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't mean you have to talk. Honesty doesn't mean you have to say what's on your mind, you know, like,
right, right, right.
Who cares what's on your mind? Who cares what's on my mind?
So I guess in that way too, you know, honesty is one of those things. It's a virtue that can be either good or bad. You can be overly honest in the way that you become a gab, you know, you're just gabbing about everything you see and hear, and you're being honest. That's what I heard. You know, whether or not it's
honest opinion and honesty, I think, are two different things.
Right.
Yeah. Right. If someone said, Aaron, did you steal that horse? Yes or no. That's a yes or no. And I think that's what you're talking about, where there's no like wrong way to be honest. You're just honest. Now to say, now you could argue, you could say like, Aaron, do you want to steal that horse? I could say, well,
yeah,
no. I mean, I do, but I don't. I'm telling you the truth, but it's not anything. I'm not telling you anything. It's an honest opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think what people are confusing today, especially young people, is honest opinions are truth.
Right.
And they're not.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Unfortunately, big difference there. There's a big difference there. And I think nowadays, if you're from that 16 to probably 23 age, they've been groomed to kind of believe that how they feel is valid. And
well, I mean, it is.
Yeah, it's valid.
It is, but
I guess, should it be adhered to? How you feel? And that's a different thing, right? That's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Like when people say, well, this is my truth. Well, and that's probably right. You're right. I can't tell you what your truth is, but what I can say is it means to me. You know, like that's
it means what I you cut it out means there.
You know. And that's something I've struggled with in my own life, was thinking that because I said it should be taken as like, well, Aaron's saying this is what he feels. No, I've learned that's not the way the world works. My truth could be a lie to you.
Right.
And my rights end where yours begin. So it's not this idea of interpretation of honesty and dishonesty. It starts to get real convoluted because we're so ingrained with the Christian sense of honesty and morality.
Even
traditional people.
No, you're right. That leads me to this quest that I've been on, and I think that a lot of these podcasts we're trying to edge toward is, you know, what is the, how do we get a collective sense of reality? So then the truth, when somebody speaks it, there's no question, you know, that we will all collectively believe that. And I don't know if that plays into this idea of individuality or individualism in the United States, where, like you said, my feelings are valid no matter what your feelings are. you know, it seems like, and again, I don't know. And I don't want to romanticize or, you know, Disneyfy the past, but it seemed like there was this collective truth, this understanding, and it seemed to be embodied in a way in how people trusted their leadership in a way. But then again, you know, I may be romanticizing that thought, because you can disagree with your leadership, but you just got to go a different way, a different route with a different band, I guess, you know, and you see that happening today, just like we talked about earlier. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm on the right track on that.
Well, I don't
either.
It's
even possible.
I don't even know if to me, this podcast, like Tribal Research Specialist, is like the think tank for, like, I don't know a lot, you know, but I have a lot of thoughts and a lot of like, is this valid? So if someone's listening to this and say, no, Aaron, you're completely wrong about that, email us, tell me, because I want to know. I'm all about learning.
Yeah.
And I could be way off base, but
yeah,
but
we want you on the podcast.
We want you on the podcast. Yeah.
If you're out there listening and say, what a bunch of baloney.
Hey, speaking of that, we should have Mike on soon, LaFron Boys.
All right. Let's do it.
Yes. Let's have
a repeat. All right. Let's do it.
Well, there's a little more.
No, I get you.
Yeah. The tribal thing. Tribal
the vibe is different. The
vibe's different. Let's have him on. But what I would say is that maybe we should dedicate a whole episode to just this idea of morality and these virtues. In the crow story of the Big Dipper, the seven bighorn sheep, they saved this little boy, and they give him the name Big Metal. He was thrown off of a cliff by his stepfather, but each of those bighorn sheep give him a gift, and the last one gives him a name. So there's this idea of like saying, this is what we want for you, or this is what you have. Some of them are tangible gifts, like the ability to run fast or to have sure-footedness in the mountains. But then several of them give him like these virtues, which is like honesty. The ability to say, to be steadfast, right? Like deliberate in your movements and like how you speak and you say what you mean. Like they're giving him these things. So I would have to explore that story more to really understand at least a traditional sense of what these virtues are. Because essentially that's what we're talking about, is individual virtues. And what's an individual virtue versus a tribal one?
Yeah, that's an important one. That's an important one, and I've been going down this road for a good solid 10 to 12 years, trying to find examples in the historical narrative, in the oral history, in the creation stories to hone in on what might have been some of the important virtues. And I think that it's, for the most part, it seems common across I guess just the human spectrum, you know, of things. I don't think Indians were any different than any other group of people, you know, as far as talking about the older tribal societies or tribal lives. But they're just expressed differently in different instances. And this idea of individualized truths becomes problematic. And I don't know where that comes in. I don't know which society that comes in from. I mean, we can point the fingers at many different groups, but I'm less interested in that and more interested in saying, okay, what are the important virtues that held us together as a tribal group or tribal bands to have us all believe in a fairly common set of things? And we lost some of that, and how can we get that back? If we can identify those, maybe there's a pathway back. I don't know. That's just my wish. That's my wish.
Yeah. And the problem there though is virtue is tied so closely to Christianity that, and I'm not saying Christianity is bad. What I'm saying is that it's foreign. The concepts are foreign. So, yeah. And I'm sure you could look through the Bible and find things you say, well, this is exactly how tribal people think. That's fine. There's a lot of overlap in a lot of things, and I'm not saying right. anything negative. What I'm saying is, if you're trying to find the authentic tribal form of virtues, you have to separate yeah. yourself from the church, or separate your culture from the church. The problem there is that some tribes have been dealing, well, like here, like Flathead's been dealing with this since the 1830s, like the late 1830s. So
yeah,
that's quite a long time to try to like,
it is.
To rip that organism away from each other.
Right.
And to say, well, right. what's there? Because then people are going to, if you ask about virtues, they're going to tie it directly, even unknowingly, to the Judeo-Christian form of virtue. I think the word itself even is a Christian word.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Can you have negative virtues?
You know what? Yeah, I mean, like I said, a virtue can go either way. It just depends on the end product. You know, like if you think of bravery as a virtue, it can be used good or bad, but I don't know. I did a lot of reading on this a few years back. It's a little gray in my head. So I think if we did return and talk about this specifically, I can revisit my notes on that and figure that out, because I seem to think all virtues have a like this a characteristic that's both good and bad.
Well, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
I cut you off there, and our listeners are going to be like, "Man, Aaron's chatty."
What was he going to say?
Yeah, what's he going to say? Were you going to say anything?
Now we'll never know.
I'll quit talking.
What is it? Finish. You did it already.
I'm going to.
What do you want to know?
I'm going to put a challenge out there a little bit.
Let's do it.
Can you understand your own tribe's virtue and qualities, the moralities of your tribe, without being a practitioner of ceremony?
Yeah.
What's your thoughts? Well,
I would say you could. I would guess that you would have needed some sort of guide to gain that particular virtue in a way, and I think the pathway to that is many. It's not necessarily engaging in ceremonial life. I think you can get it in other ways. But I think the importance of understanding your own history and your own traditions in the context of that virtue would be stronger if it came from, I guess, a ceremonial or a practitioner's a way of arriving to that. But I think the idea of, maybe I'm wrong, because now I'm thinking back to our discussion about honesty. I don't know. But this is what I was going to say. So there's like a maximum or like a breakthrough where a virtue becomes ideal, or like that's where I want it to be. So I'm not so truthful. I'm just a gab, you know, and I'm a cad walking around saying all my opinions as truth, or everything I see, I'm repeating it. You know, that guy's overweight. That kid's too noisy. You know, I'm maximizing my honesty to the point where it's annoying, or I hold my honesty in so much that it becomes a fault where I'm not. I what I do say is honest, but I don't say it enough. So then I'm reserving a lot of that and not imparting that honesty out where it needs to be. So there's some sort of maximum in that where you're not saying too much, but you're not saying too little. So that idea of a virtue can swing between good and bad. I think that's just my thought.
Yeah, so I would agree with that. Yeah. I think.
Yeah, if you think of another one like bravery, I mean, there's a big difference between bravery and courage, right?
And stupidity.
Bravery is... Yeah, bravery is just you're without fear, and sometimes you need fear to guide your decision making. So bravery is not always the virtue you need. Sometimes you need courage. So you have fear, but you're going to do that action anyway.
Yeah, I think that's the difference. One of the differences with tribal people, warriors, they say, well, they're brave. Well, I do think they were fearful, but I also think that's why they did it. I think they'd say, well, right, I'm going to do things that are scary. I want to collect deeds. I want people to say, hey, Aaron's medicine is this, or Sean Dean's like this, because he tested himself. If you were just an idiot, I'd be like, well, he's dumb. He doesn't know. He just runs in there. You know what I mean? It's like, well, no, he doesn't want to do it, but he's going to do it. And I think that's why those standards were set to be things that brought fear. And I think tribal people have adopted this, especially tribal men. We've adopted this like, I'm a machismo, which I don't think existed before. I think it was more, I think they were men and they were the hardiest of men, but I also think they were like very in tune with like, well, I don't feel that right about this. You know, you had to be had this sense of like, you had to have strong sense of yourself, and you had to understand like a good day versus a bad day. And like, it's much like boxers and MMA fighters and people in combat sports, I think, understand that, where like, the difference between courage and bravery, you know?
Yeah. There's definitely a difference in, I think it needs to be explored a little more. I mean, I definitely don't have the answers. I have a lot of narratives from the literature and from the history here. Instances of virtues in practice and kind of their origins or where they come from. And I also have a lot of narratives of the contrary, where, you know, folks weren't so, and that's more recent, where people are definitely not virtuous. But now it's just, I have this job of tying this all together to where people kind of understand the benefit of it. But then, like you said, importantly, how do you tie it into practice? Because you can read about it, you can list it, categorize it, but if it's not a practice, then what good is it? It's just a history book, you know, at that point. So that's I don't know.
I just burned my tongue. No, man, it's a tough one. Maybe I guess we made an episode too, because we've talked for a half hour about it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, we need to hear from our audience.
We do. I think we've exhausted what we know about it at this point.
Yeah, because I'm not a psychologist. I'm not. Yeah, I think so.
What else? What else aren't you?
Oh, man.
You're not a postman.
Not a postman.
Not a firefighter.
That's my truth. You know, I have two regrets in life. Well, I have like 15 to 30 regrets. You know, when you hear people say, I have no regrets. I think it's such a sham when people say that. They're like, I have no regrets. I have a lot of regrets, like a lot. Right? On the spectrum of like how impactful they are. But I for sure have a lot of regrets in life. I regret not taking college seriously earlier in life. I regret the time I turned down a job, and that could have led to, you know. But
yeah,
I wanted to be a structured firefighter, and I never pursued it.
That's a serious regret.
Yeah, like I always wanted to do. Well,
You're young. You're young, man. Follow your dreams.
I will. Maybe I will. I'll look into it.
You know, there's a volunteer fire department. You just got to show up when that siren rings and
when duty calls.
When duty calls.
You know, when I was a kid, there was a movie that came out called Backdraft.
Yeah.
Do you remember that movie?
I do. Michael Douglas. Was it Michael Douglas?
I think so.
Can't the remember the young from, guy's name.
The guy from, what's his name?
Yeah.
From, I can't remember.
He's from but the that movie that had the apartments with all the cameras in it, and he was spying on everybody.
Yeah.
No.
What was that movie? Yeah. No. Wasn't that it?
No, I think it was. Yeah.
Was it? No. No.
I don't know.
What the heck was that guy? Oh, Big Trouble in Little China. What's that guy, the main actor?
That's not Michael Douglas. Oh, no, that's not Mike. No, Michael Douglas. No,
that's
what is his name? Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
He's on there. So Kurt that Russell. Movie,
yeah.
Not well, Michael Douglas. I wanted Douglas. To be a firefighter Kurt. After that. After and I watched that
William
movie.
William Baldwin was the young guy. Yeah. Michael, you wanted to be a firefighter after you watched that movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A William structure Baldwin firefighter.
Was a young, not just any old firefighter. Structure.
No, like, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to be a structure firefighter. I wanted to like the the red fire truck and like I was just talking to Misty about this like
yeah.
a couple of days ago. I was like, you remember that movie Backdraft? And I said, I want to be a firefighter, and we started talking about firefighting. And I don't know
either. That's an interesting regret. Thanks for sharing that.
Well, it's my truth.
I yeah, nobody could tell me any different. Let's cut her off there.
All right.
And then we're gonna revisit ideas, though. This though.
Show ideas. If people out there got an idea for a topic they want to hear us discuss or an idea for a guest even. Hit us up.
We're getting back. Hit us up. Yeah. We're back on it. We're back on the podcast trail. This is gonna kick us back off. Yeah.
Oh, and I was a guest. I was a guest on the Extreme History podcast a couple of weeks ago. So it's on Spotify if you guys want to listen to it or go follow or go search out, download the Extreme History podcast. I think it's called something in the dirt, life in the dirt or down in the dirt or something like that. But
check it out.
If you just look up Extreme History Project, it comes up. So go follow
Google it. Extreme History Project.
Yeah, it's on Spotify.
Check them out.
I've seen it. Yeah, and it's on all where you get your podcasts.
Well, we'll put the link in. We'll put the link in on this show. People can check it out.
Yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes. So you guys check it out.
Let's do it. All right. Cool. Well, we're out then.
We're out. See you down the road.
Alright, thank you for joining us on this episode. And if you want to learn more about what we're up to, go ahead and search Tribal Research Specialists in Twitter, Facebook, or YouTube, and check out our other sites. And if you want to contribute to the show, go ahead and look us up on Patreon. We would appreciate your donations.